Good. Hello. Thank you very much for the introduction and also for the invitation to be here. And we had some interesting emails because you asked me, can you speak about education and democracy and John Dewey? And I had made this promise, and I had made it several times already in public, that I do not want to speak again about John Dewey because I've been doing that too many times. So what I'll do, it's risky to say, I'll try to give you something better than John Dewey, but let's see if that works. I'll talk about the beautiful risk of education, which was the sort of the topic, the title I was asked to speak about. And I want to link that to the schools of tomorrow. And the point I'm working towards with some sidesteps is to make an argument why the school as a special place in our society is really important. And I'll try to build up that argument looking at society, looking at education, and looking at democracy. So that's my plan. And in a sense, it tries to respond to a number of questions I was also asked to ponder: the task of educators in face of huge transformations in society, what we do in schools with that, and what that means for democracy and education. They are important questions, they are urgent questions, but they're also terribly difficult. So what I'll try to do is to give an educational response to that set of questions, and I'll try to show that the educational response necessarily brings us also to the question of democracy. That's what I'll try to do. I am aware and also very grateful that this is being translated into German for people who are better in German, but the problem is that the word education can be translated in a number of different German words. I think what I have in mind when I use the word is closer to Erziehung than to Bildung, so maybe you want to bear that in mind as well. This notion, Beautiful Risk of Education, is the title of a book I published a couple of years ago, but it makes sense to see that book in connection with a number of other books. This looks a bit like advertising for my books, which probably is it as well. There is a book I published in 2006 called Beyond Learning, in which I express concerns about the language of learning and education, and that's a theme in my talk. After that, I wrote a book, Good Education in an Age of Measurement, in which I also raise questions about this whole cult and culture of measurement, but also argue that we need to go back to the very basic but often forgotten question, what is education actually for? In The Beautiful Risk of Education, I try to make a positive case, you could say, for the fact that education is not only an open process, but actually ought to be an open process, and that's a little theme that will come back. And the book that is about to come out, The Rediscovery of Teaching, turns all that in an argument for teaching, which in a sense is an argument against learning, and I'll come back to that. But it's not a conservative argument for teaching. It is an attempt to make a progressive argument for teaching. In the book, I call it a progressive argument for a conservative idea. And what I'll try to do in my talk is to make a similar progressive argument for the school as, in a sense, a conservative institution. Also in the sense in which Hannah Arendt talks about the conservative as conserving what is worth conserving. And there we also get into the whole question of not only how we look towards the future, but also how we relate to our past. But between past and future, we find the present. And the big question that I want to start with is, how do we make sense of the present? How can we characterize the time we are in? And in the questions, already mention is made of migration, digitization, and when you look around, you see kind of all kind of discussions This is a big one at the moment, the Anthropocene, that tries to characterize and say we now live in a time where we actually live in a world completely affected by our existence as human beings. I want to give a slightly different characterization of our time by saying our time is the time of shopping. And it connects a bit back to what was also discussed before the break. What I mean by the shopping time is that shopping has become a defining paradigm of our age. And by calling it a paradigm, I want to highlight what I call here the logic of shopping. And what is the logic of shopping? It's basically that you desire something, you want something, and you go to a shop or to a marketplace to get what you desire in the quickest way, the easiest way. Amazon is promising that they can deliver something within 60 minutes from ordering very soon, in the cheapest way or the best value for money to fulfill that desire that you have. What is happening with this idea? I think that a case can be made that this logic, this way of thinking, but it's also a way of being, has influenced many areas of our life. And the book that I found very inspirational there is a book that came out a couple of years ago by Paul Roberts, an American journalist called The Impulse Society, in which he makes a case that our society has more and more come into grip of this idea of impulses, desire, and the quick and effective fulfillment of our desires. The subtitle of the book in the English edition is What is Wrong with Getting What We Want? Funnily, a couple of weeks ago, I found the subtitle for the American edition, and that says, The United States in the Grip of Instant Gratification. So that's even more explicit. What is wrong with getting what we want? What the book shows is there is actually quite a lot wrong if we begin to organize our common life based just on the principle of getting what we want. And that, you can say, is the logic of the paradigm of shopping. It connects to the whole discussion about neoliberalism, but this is a slightly different way to show the issue that, for me, also will help to make the bridge to education and democracy. One area where we probably recognize this logic is the economy. We live in an age, and this age has been around for a while, where we have this idea that for the economy and economic life to exist, the economy has to grow. And for a long time, we were able to grow the economy in space. That is called colonization, finding new markets. That dynamic stopped precisely at the point where the economy became global, when the whole world had been turned into a market. The joke I like to make is to say the main reason that NASA and the European Space Agency want to go to other planets is because they are looking for new markets where we can sell stuff. So when the economy could no longer grow in space, for a fairly short period of time, the growth of the economy was done through time. That is the stock market, where as long as you are just slightly ahead of others in selling and buying stocks, you can make money out of that time difference. But with computers coming in, there was a point that all computers were as fast, and therefore we could no longer make money out of time. And this is my understanding of the most recent financial crisis, where you can say the economy ran literally out of time. When you then ask, is there still another area where the economy can grow? It is what I think is most visible in the business model of Apple. Here I make the claim, Apple doesn't sell mobile phones. Apple sells something much more brilliant. they sell the desire for a new mobile phone. That is their business model. And they sell us this desire for free, but once this desire has arrived inside us, then we're happy to give the money and get the new mobile phone in. And I have an iPhone, what is it, 6, so I think you can now desire a 7 as well. So this is a really powerful thing. So you can say, and Roberts also makes it visible, that we live in an economic system that constantly tries to get new desires inside of us so that we buy more stuff and the economy can grow. But it's not just the economy where we see that the logic of shopping is creating problems. When you look at contemporary politics, you can find the same idea, where many politicians do something like this, where they say, if you vote for me, I'll promise that I'll give you what you desire. Of course, we know that once politicians are voted in, they encounter that they cannot give everything that they promised, and then voters get frustrated, and that helps to understand a lot of what's going on currently in politics. But it shows again that politicians nowadays far less say, if you vote for me, I will present you with some difficult questions about your desires. But the questions I ask as a social democrat are, for example, different from the difficult questions you'll get from a liberal politician. It's a different logic there. So I would claim that in politics we also see the logic of shopping emerging. It also affects democracy itself, and I'll mention this quickly because I'll come back to democracy a little later in the talk. I think we are finding a lot of problems around the idea of democracy linked to the desire that many groups have to live together in society but keep their identity pure. And if everyone wants to keep their identity pure, before you know it, you end up in a clash of identities that I think is eroding democracy. I'll come back to that point. And then you can say our planet, the environmental problems we are facing, are also to a large extent the result of this logic of the paradigm of shopping, where for far too long we have just treated the planet as an infinite resource where we could project all our desires onto. But the planet has been saying to us for a long time already, I can't give you everything you want. So this is my quick assessment of one of the bigger themes that we are facing in contemporary times and society. And the one area I haven't mentioned yet, but I'll go to that now, is education itself, because I think there is at least a risk in education, but I actually see quite a lot of examples of that, where I think our educational institutions have also ended up in this particular paradigm, where we are beginning to treat schools, colleges, universities as shops. And this is the kind of language that I see. I can keep it close to home and look at the university where I work, where we're constantly being told the students we have now pay an awful lot of money to be here. They are our customers and we need to give them what they want and we need to keep them satisfied. So there is a view of education that focuses on students and says this is the place where you can learn what you want to learn, where the teachers are not there to ask you difficult questions or give you what you do not want, but the teachers facilitate your learning, and where ultimately questions about quality and good education become connected to how satisfied students are. And in the United Kingdom, there is indeed a national student satisfaction survey. And I simply don't like the word satisfaction in that. Satisfaction to me sounds like lazy. I always say if my students are satisfied, I have failed as a teacher because I haven't gone to a more difficult place. I think online learning also carries these kind of promises that on the internet we will find exactly what we want to learn. I think that's true, and in a minute I will argue that this is the main reasons why we need schools, but why we need schools in a very particular way. So there is old student-centered education that was referenced in the earlier session about progressive education in the beginning of the 20th century, which really tried to move away from the books towards the child and the student. I think what we are facing now is a period of new student-centered education, where the student appears as a consumer. And then you can ask what is missing in this picture. And of course, I have to do this quickly, so it lacks a bit of nuance, but hopefully it helps in the discussion and thinking about some of these issues. I would say what is missing in this picture, what is missing in this paradigm, in all these different domains, is an encounter with the real, an encounter with reality. For example, the encounter with other human beings who are not like we are. The encounter with a planet that is not just a construction, but that imposes real limits on our infinite desires. And you can say what maybe we're also missing here, and these are some other dimensions of what's going on. What's missing is also an encounter with the otherness in ourselves and our body. There is literature that tries to show that we are treating our body also as an object that we can mold according to our desires. The risk here, and that's the risk I see as an educator, not as a political thinker, is that this kind of education runs the risk of what in some literature is called of being egological, working entirely according to the logic of the ego, and particularly the desires that the ego articulates. Such a way of being in the world, where you just follow your desires, you can say, we could call infantile, although I immediately want to mention this is not to give infants or children a bad name, because I think it's more often that we as adults struggle with what we do with our desires than that this is something that children are unable to engage with. Now, if this gives at least one angle on how we might understand some of the things that are not just happening around us, but that we're also very much part of, and some of these developments come out of good intentions, but then get connected to problematic developments, then I would say again, as an educator, that maybe one of the biggest tasks for education today, moving towards the future, has to do with the whole question of the desires we find in ourselves, the desires we articulate as individuals and as groups. And you can say a big task for education there is to figure out how we can put our desires in perspective. Or better than perspective, I would say the big challenge for education is how we can put our own desires in dialogue with the reality that exists outside of ourselves. I'm very much inspired by a French educational thinker, Philippe Mérieux, who says very nicely here in French, toute la pédagogie est un travail compliqué pour aider l'enfant à se dégager de la logique du caprice. So he's saying, all the work of education is the difficult work to help children to, you can say, create a space between their desires and themselves. And if a life that just follows desires might be carefully characterized as an infantile way of being in the world, you can say that here in this challenge we find an old educational theme, the theme of trying to exist in a grown-up way. And again, Mérieux gives a very nice, simple, but profound definition of what trying to live your life in a grown-up way means. He says, it's being in the world without, you can say, putting yourself in the center of the world. It's a decentered way of trying to exist. What I also like is to say this is an eccentric way of trying to exist. And I'll probably argue for a pedagogy that needs to foster that kind of eccentricity. Now, the theme is old, and the way in which, as educators, we've tried to engage with this theme is a way with a problematic history. It's known in the literature as moralizing pedagogy or moralizing education, where we as the sitting generation think that we can tell children and young people what they should desire, what they shouldn't desire. That, you can say, is the pedagogy that we rightly need to get away from. It's authoritarian education. But to get away from authoritarian or moralizing education does not mean that we can leave the normative question, the question of the good life and the good existence, leave that question behind. So I would re-articulate the educational task here by saying part of our work as educators is to make the question about the perspective on our desires, the question, is what I desire desirable, to make that into a living question. And if you were to ask me, and I'm aware we have no time for you to ask this, but after the talk there is time for questions, the most precise formulation I can give of the task of education and the educator is to arouse the desire in another human being for wanting to exist in the world in a grown-up way. For me, that is what lies ahead of us, particularly in a world that is so driven by desires, to arouse in another human being the desire for wanting to exist in the world in a grown-up way. The question then is, what kind of meaning is there in this way of talking about education, and what kind of work does it require from educators, and what kind of places do we need for this work? So those are the three questions. What's in this description? What kind of educational work follows out of that? And what kind of places do we need to make this work possible? And I want to say something in response to each of these points and then link it to the bigger question of democracy. So in this formulation, arousing desire for wanting to exist in a grown-up way, there is this idea of existing in the world. And I want to look briefly at this question because it has a lot to do with the place of the real and reality in education. What does it mean to be in the world, to encounter the world? It means that at some point we encounter resistance. And the experience of resistance, that something resists my intentions, my desires, my actions, my initiatives, is a very important encounter and a very important experience, because when we experience that, we experience that the world is not a construction, but does exist outside of us and independently of us in its own integrity. Freud calls this the reality principle and makes it into an important step in the development of the person. The question is what we do when we encounter resistance. Now, I don't know what you do when you encounter resistance, but I can tell you what I experience when I encounter resistance, because the encounter with resistance is first of all a frustrating experience. You have a good idea, you have the intention to do something, and suddenly you meet something that says, stop, this is not as easy as you think it is. Out of that frustration, one thing I can imagine and sometimes see myself doing is that I think, okay, I'm going to push harder because this probably requires more energy. And sometimes that's what we need to do. We need to push hard to make things real. But there is always a risk that if we push too hard, that we destroy the very place, the very world where we want to arrive. So you can say at one extreme, there is the risk of the destruction of the world if we only want to put energy in getting our ideas through. The other thing that can be done out of this frustration is that we say, oh, this is far too difficult, I can't cope with the world and its reality. And then we begin to withdraw. We say, I'm not going to do that again. And sometimes that's also what we need to do. We need to leave space for things to happen. But maybe you can see that if we go too far in that, we withdraw ourselves completely from the world and we can no longer exist in the world. So we destroy ourselves, you could say. That means that this simple idea to say the task of education has to do with trying to be in the world actually points at a very particular space, a middle ground, as I like to call it, between these two extremes of world destruction and self-destruction. That, you can say, is the place where the real educational work takes place. And when you begin to think about that, also as a teacher, I was at a presentation yesterday from a language teacher who found this very helpful to understand what he was trying to do with his students in reading a simple text. You can begin to see that these risks of world destruction and self-destruction, in a sense, are always encircling where we try to keep our students. We could call this middle ground the place of dialogue, but then dialogue not as conversation, but you can say as an existential form, trying constantly to be in dialogue with what is outside of us. And a dialogue is very different from a competition. One of the sad things about contemporary education is that it has been made into a worldwide competition. We have all the league tables with Finland or Singapore at the top and everyone below, and it creates a very unhelpful dynamic in thinking about what education is. The brilliant thing about a dialogue is that in a dialogue there is never a winner. A dialogue is a lifelong challenge, and the challenge never stops. So this says something about what does it actually mean to be in the world and what are the dangers there. But I've qualified that being in the world by talking about it in terms of being there in a grown-up way. Now, grown-upness is a strange, and you can say an unhelpful or awkward concept, partly because a lot of people, sort of their first reaction will go back to moralizing education, where other people were telling us, be grown up, act in this way, not that way. But also because grown up suggests a kind of developmental trajectory, where we develop and then at some point we are suddenly grown up for the rest of our lives. I want to think about grown-upness in a different way, not as a developmental achievement, but again as a challenge that's always ahead of us, a in each situation, anything that we encounter, there is always the question, will I just pursue my own desires, or will I be able to put them in the perspective of what I meet there? So that is very nicely there in Merieux's description, being in the world, being out there, being in that middle ground, but not thinking yourself and your desires as the center of the universe. And by taking it away from developmental thinking, we can begin to see that people like us who have been around for a while or for a pretty long while are not necessarily better at existing in this grown-up way than the young people who are just arriving on this planet. I often think actually the opposite when I used to say when I open the newspaper in the morning, but now when I look on my news app on my phone, I see many examples of people like us who live their lives in very ungrown-up ways. And when I go to schools and see young people, and sometimes very young people in preschool or kindergarten, and how they are able to be together but not in the center of what's happening, that's very impressive. So it's very important not to think that this is a question of age. It's a question of what we manage to do. Precisely in this notion of trying to exist in a grown-up way, do we find what I think is the most central educational question, this question about our own desires. Is what I desire desirable? Is what I desire, or what I find as a desire in myself, is that what I should desire? And that is a question that we always need to ask in relation to our own life. Is this going to help me to live a good life? But also our life with others, and that's where the question of democracy begins to enter. And our physical location, the planet that, as I said, put limits on our desires. Now, to ponder that question means that we put our desires in perspective, but it's not to suppress our desires. That's, again, old pedagogy, and in some circles I would say this is sort of Catholic pedagogy that says desire is sin, and if we get rid of our desires, then we got rid of sin, and then we are in heaven. We need our desires because they give us the energy to be in the world. But the real question is, how do we rework our desires so that they can help us with that? Spivak has a very nice definition of education, actually, where she says, education is the uncoercive rearrangement of desires. I like the idea of rearrangement of desires. Uncoercive sounds a bit too happy to me. I think, for example, in relation to the environmental problems, we feel a certain coercion coming from the planet to really rein in our desires. Now, this is a particular way to look at education and the educational task, and it's not what you read in reports from the OECD, who have a very different view of what education is. Out of those views also come very particular prescriptions, you could almost say, for what teachers should be doing. And many teachers are caught in situations where their job has become redefined as driving up student test scores, which I think has little to do with education. So if you look at education in this way, in a more existential, political, human way, the work of educators, the work of teachers, begins to look differently as well, or it begins to highlight different things that are important for teachers to work on. And I want to just mention three dimensions of this to give a sense of how we need to start very differently about the work of teachers and educators. Acknowledging that the work of teachers and teaching is interruptive, that it needs to bring in suspension and needs to provide sustenance. Why is the work of teachers interruptive? Particularly because one of the things we are working on in this domain of the difference between the non-grown-up and the grown-up is the interruption of desires. Not just desires we have towards the outside world, but you can say also desires we have about ourselves. So it's the way in which we interrupt other human beings to the degree they are with themselves. And I also put here, but it's a big discussion, I think the task of education is ultimately also the interruption of identity, or maybe to say it a bit more precise, of the desire for pure identity. That is a way to think about the educational work that is geared towards the existence in the world. And that's why I often prefer to talk about these ideas as a view of world-centered education. That's very different both from child-centered education and from curriculum-centered education. It's a question of turning or returning students towards the world. You can say it's trying to move students to this middle ground. That means that education is a difficult process. So all the advertising that says, come to our university and we make life easy for you, I think that shows either that that university is not going to give you an education or that the advertising is not telling what really should be happening there. If the work is to help the next generation to see their desires, meet their desires, and figure out what to do with their desires, then education needs first of all time to do that, but also need to provide forms and create space where this work can be done. So against the idea that the fastest education is the best education, and again, I see that a lot, this is an argument for education that slows down, that says, wait a minute, look again, but that also provides forms and spaces where that can be done. And the school can be a place for slowing down rather than to go with the speed of society. Doing that means that the school, the educational space, becomes a space for practicing, for trying out, for meeting our desires and trying out what would it mean for this desire to grow, for this desire to diminish, for this desire to transform. That's difficult and hard work. If that is where we want to try to bring our students or keep our students, then you can say, then there is also a responsibility on us as educators to help them to stay there. And that's where I really like this as an English word, the sustenance is important, the nourishing, the support for staying in the difficult middle ground. Particularly because in many educational settings, we find this tension between the short-term perspective and the longer-term perspective. And often what students encounter as difficult in the short term may turn out to be valuable in the longer term. We can come back to that, but it's one reason why when students encounter difficulties, we should not simply try to take those difficulties away, but always ask, is there a shorter term and a longer term perspective? That doesn't mean that the school turns into a therapy room, and particularly not psychotherapy. I want to emphasize that the curriculum remains really important, maybe even becomes more important, but not as the knowledge and skills that need to be internalized or learned, but because the curriculum gives us ways of meeting the world and meeting ourselves in relation to the world. So for all the mathematics teachers in the room, if there are any, I want to ask the question, so what is the particular way in which we meet the world and ourselves through mathematics? What is the particular way in which we meet the world and ourselves through language, geography, the arts, gardening? I'm particularly a big fan of gardening in schools because I think that a lot of education has become very cognitive. It happens in the head, and with mathematics and language and geography and history, maybe you can do that. The brilliant thing about gardening, about having a plant, for example, is that you can think as hard as you want about a plant, but the plant will not grow any faster as a result of that. So in the experience of gardening, you meet a reality that actually needs its own time, and it puts you very differently in relation to that. That is how we need to begin to look at the curriculum. Out of that, I would also say, and that's my penultimate point, and then I'll say a few things about democracy. If this is the educational work, if it's the work of slowing down, of meeting the world, meeting yourself and your desires in relation to the world, that is nowadays very difficult to do in a society that actually wants to go at the highest speed possible and is only interested in our desires, but not in this difficult question, what do we do with our desires? For me, this is an important reason why tomorrow needs the school. And I want to add to that, and it's a quick point, but a longer conversation. I think we should be very careful not to defend the importance of the school by calling it a place for learning. And the reason for that is that I'm pretty sure that most of what happens under learning can, or within 10 years, can be done much quicker and faster and more effective online. Google already has the plans ready for that. Pearson has the plans ready for that. And they'll make a lot of money out of it. But that is if we only think that the job of the school is to learn. But learning now can be done everywhere. But to have a place in our societies, in our lives, where we encounter difficult questions, the things we didn't look for, or the things we didn't even know we could look for, that for me remains an important reason for having the school, precisely as a place that slows down, that has a different logic from the logic outside. So I'm also for a bit stronger borders than just this borderland. A place to practice grown-upness. And when you ask, what is this practicing? There is a brilliant quote by Samuel Beckett where he says, that is to try, to fail, to try again, and to fail better. Because perfection we will never reach, but we need to keep being engaged in trying to exist in the world in this grown-up way. Finally, I hope I'm just okay with time. What then about democracy? The point I'd like to make here is that the way in which I have presented the educational question, as the question of existing in the world in a grown-up way, as the question of not just running behind your desires, is also the democratic question. But then we have to be very careful that we do not conflate democracy with, you can say, the will of the majority. And there was an interesting phrase, I encountered it in Hannah Arendt's work, but I looked back and apparently John Adams, the second president of the United States, uses it already. Democracy is something different from what he calls the tyranny of the majority. It's not a question of just counting. And again, you could say that's where we currently are a bit stuck with what is called populism, that we think democracy is just counting the desires that people articulate. I would say the real challenge, but also the worth of democracy, is that we all bring our desires to the table and then see which of our individual and particular desires can be carried collectively. So democracy is about transformation of individual desires into what is collectively desirable. And that's a difficult process where our desires are really brought into dialogue. And we do that with reference to a number of important values or markers: liberty, equality, and solidarity. And that makes democracy into something very complex. So you could say, well, that probably means that we need to go deep into political philosophy to understand what democracy is. But I'll go somewhere else, because this for me is the key message of democracy. Rolling Stones: in a democracy, you can't always get what you want. And therefore, in a democratic society, we need places where we meet this frustrating experience and do not immediately explode because of the frustration, but work through forms and get time and space to practice the encounter with this fundamental difficulty of living together. Why is all this educational work that is explicitly connected to a democratic future, why is that risky work, and why is that a risk worth taking, a beautiful risk? It's partly because, as I said, education is an open process, because it's an encounter between human beings, not between robots. But when you look carefully at some policy, it actually would love to make schools into just robots where everyone acts according to script, so that you get something that is totally predictable. That kills education. But it's also a risk, because what's ultimately at stake in education is the freedom of each and every human being. Where in education, as educators, we meet students as free subjects, not as objects where we just pour in something or just want them to learn. But that freedom, and that has been my message, I think, is not to be understood as neoliberal freedom, the freedom to do what you want to do, the freedom of shopping, but it is the grown-up freedom, where we always put our desires in the perspective of the reality in which we can live our lives. And that, you can say, is at least central in a democratic society, where I would say a democratic society gives freedom to all its citizens. And a lot of people nowadays say, okay, that's fine, I get freedom, that's the package. And they forget that in that same gesture, a democratic society asks from all their citizens to use that freedom in a grown-up way. So that's to summarize why I would argue that tomorrow needs education, not just learning, because this learning can happen everywhere, but education touches upon this task we find in front of us as human beings, and the task as educators we have to arouse the desire in the new generation for wanting to be in the world, but in this special grown-up way. That's why I would say that we need to move beyond this ongoing, should education be child-centered or student-centered, should it be curriculum-centered, and try to think of education as world-centered, that ultimately what is at stake is how we manage to live together in the world, but not in the center of it. And that's why I would like to argue that tomorrow indeed needs the school as a special place that is not the same as society, that is out of place, The Greek word skola means, amongst other things, free time. You could say that is precisely the time that we as society give to the next generation to practice, to figure out what it means to live together in the world. For me, that would be the ambition for the schools of tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you.